Of Artificer Creation.
Welcome to episode 144 of the Let's Talk Photography podcast. I'm your host, Bart Bouchotz, and this is the show for September 2025. Having had the pleasure of Alison Sheridan's company last month for Let's Talk Photography 143, this show, which is just little old me, is also inspired by a conversation with Alison Sheridan, who of course is friend of the show and host of the wonderful NozillaCast podcast over at podfeet.com. Alison had me on her most recent show to answer her questions about how it is that the iPhone 17 Pro has three holes on the back, for want of a better word. I thought it was a funny way of phrasing it. But the camera app seems to suggest that there are more than three modes that are somehow related to having a physical lens. So what's going on? Alison is an engineer by training, so thinks in a very methodical engineering sort of way. So she came armed with tables and very specific questions. And we had a very fun conversation to answer Alison's questions. But that's a focused conversation around A, Alison's questions, and B, the iPhone 17 Pro. And this show here is intentionally gear agnostic. This is the art and craft of photography. But there actually is a good relationship between the very specific questions Alison asked and a bigger discussion that I think is worth having here. So Apple are arguably the best at making phones take amazing photographs. You may quibble with me on that, but even if you do quibble with me on that, or even if maybe every now and then there's a little bit of jockeying going on and Apple lose the top spot for a couple of months and then come out with something new, one thing that is definitely beyond debate is that Apple are extremely good at this. They are in the top tier at this. But the technologies they lean on to achieve that are not unique to Apple. I would argue that Apple's strength comes from combining those technologies extremely well, extremely efficiently, and extremely elegantly, in large part because they both make the hardware and the software, which allows them to blend these things together in a better way to others, and also because of Apple's focus on creating products, not technology. And so the iPhone camera app actually hides a lot of the complexity. And, you know, in sort of the nerdy Linux land I live in during my day job, that kind of hiding is seen as negative, which is why, you know, servers run Linux. You don't want to hide things on a server OS. But on a consumer-facing OS that is also running Unix, actually, hiding the complexity is a feature, not a bug. And so it is undeniable that Apple are brilliant at this, but they're not alone at this. Others do it too. And the toolbox full of techniques that Apple deploy is also not unique to Apple. So actually there is value in having a broader description of what these tools are, because other high-end phone makers are using the same approaches, the same techniques to give their camera apps similar, although differently presented sometimes and maybe not quite as able in some situations, but similar features where you have one camera app appearing to show one camera, which is made up of multiple physical cameras on the back of the phone that are somehow working together in concert to produce this fantastic whole. So the reason our phone cameras have stopped resembling traditional cameras like they have is physics. The laws of physics limit what is possible with the traditional digital camera approach of a good lens going into as big of a sensor as you can get away with. Well, we can make good lenses, but they have to be teeny tiny because they have to fit into a smartphone along with everything else the smartphone does. A camera has one job, take great pictures. A smartphone has many, many jobs, just one of which is take great pictures and video. So that camera can't dominate the whole thing. That camera has to play second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth fiddle. So it's actually just a tiny part of the already very tiny device. So space is at an absolute premium. The lenses are physically small. The sensors are physically small, which means that the laws of optics tell us you are always going to be fighting for a deep depth of field when you have a tiny sensor, because that's how physics works. The optics are going to limit your physical zooming, because in order to get a good zoom lens, you need length, right? Why are zoom lenses like giant big telescopes? Is because that's how the optics works. So the zoom level you can do in hardware is limited. And then the last thing is the sensors are physically limited in size too. And while the technology in them is getting ever better, there are only... each pixel must be really quite tiny, or there can't be very many of them. But either way, what you are fighting is noise. You can never have the level of noise resistance you can have with a full frame or even a Micro Four Thirds sensor. You know, these phone sensors are tiny. They are fighting an uphill battle in terms of the physics of it all. And yet, Apple and others succeed in taking amazing pictures, and that's because they think it's out of the box and they do clever things that go beyond just the traditional physics and the optics. So the optics has been stretched as much as possible by bringing in really expensive materials like sapphire and stuff into the optics. And so those lenses, while physically small, are absolutely the best they can be at that physical size. The light path has actually been extended in very clever ways Apple is not the only one to have what's called a periscoping zoom lens. Apple use a tetraprism design. I believe others have different arrangements of optics to achieve the same end. Basically, if there isn't enough room for a long light path in a thin phone, and when I say thin, I mean even the thickest smartphone is thin compared to a camera, well, then you bend the light path. So these so-called periscopic telephotos, they're all bending the light path in some way so that the light travels a non-straight path between the front of the lens and the sensor, allowing it to have the distance it needs to do the zooming. And so Apple's design is the tetraprism, others use different optics, but the end result is the same. Move the sensor physically far away from the lens by not having it be straight behind it. I believe they're all at 90 degrees and off to the side, basically. So that is very clever. These sensors themselves are also using very clever techniques, like they're back illuminated, I think is one of the phrases. But basically, they've done absolutely everything they can to make each of those teensy, teensy, tiny little pixels hoover up as many electrons as possible and be as big as possible and as tightly packed as possible, despite fizzing in a small physical size and still being high resolution. They really have pushed the boundaries of sensor design impressively. But all of it only gets them so far. So the very first piece of magic sauce to arrive in this toolbox was machine learning. And machine learning is artificial intelligence, or is a class of artificial intelligence, and it has been around so much longer than large language models, which now in people's popular imagination has been conflated with AI. We now, the average person on the street conflates the concept of artificial intelligence with large language models, with these generative AI that make things up. But they're just a particular type of artificial intelligence, and one that has been around an awful, awful lot longer, is more traditional machine learning techniques, or ML as Apple calls it. And the idea here is that you have an artificial neural network where you put some input in one side and you get some output out the other side, and you have some sort of a mechanism for measuring how much of an improvement the output is compared to the input, and you shove in millions and millions and millions of pieces of sample data, you measure the outputs, and then you basically grade the neural network in its current, in its initial random state, and see how well it does, and then you tweak it, you test it again, you tweak it, you test it again, you tweak it, you test it again, you repeat that a few million or billion times, and you end up with a neural network you absolutely do not understand, but which is extremely good at turning the input you give it into the output you told it you wanted. There is an awful lot of skill in how you go about doing that, but that is, you are literally training a neural network. And Apple were very early to the game here. Because they make their own silicon, they could start to do it in hardware rather than software very quickly. And so the reason Apple were initially better at dealing with noise and stuff like that from their more traditional phone cameras initially was because they had this amazing machine learning. And that machine learning has just grown and grown and grown and grown and grown. And it now has so many steps that it's not a piece of machine learning. It's lots and lots of pieces of machine learning chained together to do amazing cool things. And the input is not one single exposure from one single sensor through one single lens to output one single photograph. But as we'll discover as we go through this, you can have many, many inputs coming into that neural network, which all get mushed together to produce that one final photo that you see in the photo app. And so the name Apple give for all of this machine learning processing that goes on between input and output is the image pipeline. And those image pipelines are now immensely complex and, in the case of the iPhone, implemented in hardware. So they're really, really quick. So what is in that image pipeline? What is it that is happening between the physical glass or sapphire at the front of those lenses and the photo you see on the screen of the phone a fraction of a second after you tap the button? As well as just bringing machine learning to the game, the second innovation Apple had was single sensor frame stacking. It's a general rule that if you want to improve your signal to noise ratio, gather more signal or more input, because the noise is constant and the input gets reinforced by averaging together. Sorry, the noise isn't constant. The noise is random. The signal is constant. I literally had that backwards. So the noise randomly cancels itself out and the signal stays the same. So you amplify it effectively by stacking multiple shots of the same thing. And the signal grows, the noise shrinks as you keep doing that. And so one of Apple's first tricks was to take 2-3 frames or more and then use machine learning to automatically realign them so that any camera movement between those exposures is dealt with entirely automatically. So there's more machine learning in the pipeline. And then to stack the images so that the noise goes down and the signal goes up, and then use a little bit more machine learning to denoise those images more intelligently than you can with a purely mathematical algorithm, and to do some, edge detection and edge correction and stuff, again using the machine learning, training it how best to deal with noise, and you end up with these surprisingly low light, surprisingly high quality photos coming through a single teeny weeny lens and teeny weeny sensor on the, middling generation iPhones. And that was very clever. And Apple very quickly started to, once they had done the hard work for the automatic image alignment, well, now you can stack frames. So if you can stack frames anyway, then you can start to do way cooler things and simply deal with the signal to noise ratio and simply improve, basically give yourself less of a denoising problem. The other thing you can do is expand your dynamic range by, instead of taking 3 or 5 the same exposures and stacking them, well, what if you underexpose some intentionally? So you start off with a quote-unquote correct middle shot. That's what all the sensors tell you is the right exposure. And that will give you the detail in the mid-ranges. And then if there's a lot of, if there's a big dynamic range, a big difference between the brightest things in the scene in front of the camera and the darkest things in the scene in front of the camera, then if you take 1 or 2 dimmer shorter exposures, you will start to capture detail in the highlights because you're exposing too short. And then if you take 1 or 2 that are longer than the quote unquote correct one, you'll start to expose the detail in the shadows. And then if you bring into your machine learning your maybe 3 or 5 images at different exposures, well, then your machine learning can not just deal with signal to noise, but it can also start to pull back detail in the shadows and the highlights to give you a much more natural view, because the eye has a higher dynamic range than the physical sensor in cameras. And so photographs taken with digital cameras always had these really mushy shadows and really blown out highlights. And you'd look at the scene with your naked eye and it's like, well, I can see both the clouds and the leaves in the shadow of that tree. Why does my early smartphone show me black shadows and blown out clouds and only some detail in the middle? Well, that's all taken care of by stacking these different exposures together. Great. And one of the ways, if you start to stack lots of exposures, it's actually because the sensor is both for video and photography, video and still photography, the actual way Apple chose to implement this, and Apple were not alone in this, was, well, why make the camera be a camera 3 times? Why don't we let it be a video camera briefly and then stack together the frames of a short video to make one single photograph? And while you're doing that anyway, well, you have a few extra frames. So why not add that little optional, was it Live Photos, Apple brand, where we get the Harry Potter-like moving photo effect, right? That's just a side effect of it being more efficient to just flip this dual-use sensor that's already optimized to be a good video camera into video mode to produce a photograph with frame stacking. And then Apple were like, well, we're pretty good at this auto-alignment thing. What if we do that over and over and over and over and over and over and over again? And what if we take not just a, you know, half a second video, what if we take a 10-second, 30-second video and then collapse that entire frame into one single photograph? Ta-da! The amazing night modes that are on iPhones and modern high-end Android phones, right? That is taking a long video and basically auto-aligning and stacking all the frames one after the other, multiplying them together. The noise evaporates, the signal enhances, and all of a sudden you can see a comet that the naked eye couldn't see at all in your photograph. And so all of that comes from stacking multiple frames from the same sensor, one on top of the other, on top of the other, on top of the other, to build a single photograph. And that is extremely powerful. Now, later in the iPhones and other smartphones evolution, a new mode appeared called macro mode. And while a phone camera's physically small sensor means that in normal photography, the problem you have is too small of a depth of field, the way physics works is that when you bring something really, 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 really close to the lens, the depth of field collapses. And yes, the iPhone has more depth of field, and so it collapses a little bit more slowly than it would with the big DSLR. But the thing is, it doesn't actually matter what size your lens is or what size your sensor is. By the time you get something a few millimeters or an inch or so away from the front of the lens, the depth of field has gone paper thin, whether you're on a full frame sensor or a phone sensor. Everyone's problem is too little depth of field. And well, if you're stacking frames anyway, what if you use the autofocus and you intentionally focus one of them just where it should be, or if there's not a lot of light, maybe you take 3 of them just where the autofocus says you should focus, and then you intentionally autofocus too far away and take another 1 or 3 or whatever number of frames you need to capture the needed amount of light, and then you intentionally focus a little bit too near, right? On the other side, you shift the focus the other way from quote-unquote correct, the measured actual place to focus. And then you stack together those 3 or 9 or 15, depending on how many exposures you had to take at each focus distance, and then you end up with a deeper depth of field in the final image, all being done by that image pipeline. So you can end up with a lot of frames coming together for that macro mode. But actually, the macro mode arrived on the scene along with a new trick that takes the lots of frames from one sensor. So light, one lens, one sensor, lots of frames, one photo. What if we take lots of frames from more than one lens with more than one sensor, but combine them into one photograph? And what Apple said on stage, and they didn't go into a huge amount of detail, but what Apple said on stage is the reason they're able to pull as much detail as they can pull from these macro modes, and the reason they can get the focusing they can, is because they simultaneously combine images from two cameras at once to make that macro mode. So not just are you stacking frames from a single lens plus sensor, you're now stacking frames from two lens plus sensor pairs into one single final photograph. So you have multi-sensor frame stacking. And once Apple had done the machine learning needed, and the math is way more complicated because those lenses are physically not in the same place because they can't be on top of each other, they have to be beside each other, they're physically at a different focal length, right? They're physically different lenses, so there's a lot of conversion to be done to map a pixel on one sensor to its opposite number on the other sensor. It's not a straightforward mapping anymore. That's a lot of math all being done in that machine learning chip. And once Apple had done all that hard work, why only use it for the macro mode? Right, you can jump from one camera to the other camera to the other camera, depending on whether you have one, two, or three, by tapping the different full-on zoom levels. But you could always on the phone sort of zoom in between or zoom beyond the physical lenses. And what you were originally doing when you did that was interpolating. So the data was coming from, if you were, you know, less than halfway to the next lens, it was data from the lens below being interpolated, fill in the gaps. And then on the other one, it was basically a crop being stretched out for the lens on the other side of it as you got closer to that lens. And so the quality in between was always ick because it was either invented data through interpolation. It's inventing without a different kind of inventing we'll talk about later. Or you were doing a digital zoom, which means you're also sort of inventing in a slightly different way. It's different math, but the end result is the same. You don't actually have enough signal to make the image you want, and so you're sort of guessing at what the in-between signal probably would have been if you'd been able to capture it. And it's not very good. It can't find real data in there, so it's kind of assuming it's all average. Assuming it's the same as the data. Assuming the data I can't see is like the data I can see and hope for the best. But if you can combine data from multiple sensors, well, when you go between the 0.5 lens and the one lens, why not take exposures with both lenses? Then you have enough data from enough physical pixels to cover everything you want at 1.5 times, you know, at the halfway point or any point in between. Merge those together, and now you have more pixel values than you need. Therefore, you're not inventing data, you're compressing data. You're aggregating data together, and that's mathematically a whole different kettle of fish. You're not making up detail, so you get real actual detail from the real actual world. And so now that we have this ability, or these cameras have this ability to take information through multiple holes, to use Allison's word, at the same time, those in-between zooms are no longer ugly. They're now actually really quite good. They make your phone work harder because you're doing more difficult math than if you go at the full-on, you know, 1x, 0.5x, 2x, etc. zooms. But nonetheless, this multi-frame sensor stacking technique has made those in-between zooms really quite nice now. And that brings us to the last of the techniques, so-called pixel binning. So, in the early days, it was the best anyone could do to make the bloody things work at all, that the thought of having more physical pixels on the sensor than you actually used in your final images would have been heresy. It was so hard to make a 12 megapixel sensor that didn't suck that of course you were going to take 12 megapixel photos with it. And then as we've gotten physically better at making sensors, we've ended up with this strange situation where actually we can get 48 megapixels into these teensy-veensy-veensy tiny little sensors, and the 48 really good megapixels into these teensy-veensy tiny little sensors. And a 48 megapixel image, that's a lot of detail. That's more detail than most people need for most things. We're not generally printing out billboards to hang on the side of a building. We don't actually need 48 megapixels worth of data. But if you can get a 48 megapixel sensor in there, then you have another way of dealing with the signal-to-noise problem. You can take 48 megapixels of physical image, and you can reduce the megapixels in the output image, in the other side of the image pipeline, to maybe 24 pixels or 12 pixels. And that's called pixel binning, because you've data from multiple physical pixels becomes data for one single final virtual pixel. and that improves the signal to noise again. That gives you a higher quality image from the sensor. While you're doing that, while you're pixel binning anyway, well, the sensor is still a really good sensor. Each of those megapixels is as good as any pixel was in an older sensor a few years ago. So you actually can use the full 48 megapixels. So a lot of these phones, the iPhone as well, will allow you to give a high resolution image and it'll just use all the pixels, even if that's more than most people want most of the time. But the other trick you can play is, what if we don't use the whole sensor? What if we only use the centerpiece of the sensor handful, of the sensor pixels? What if we take the center 12 megapixels of that 48 megapixel camera? Well, that is an optical twice the same zoom lens. If you pull that trick off on a 1x camera, you get a 2x zoom, where there is one physical pixel for each end pixel in the final image. In other words, it is optical quality. That is how you get the 0.5, the 1, the 2, the 4, and the 8 all being optical quality zooms on the iPhone 17, which only has three holes on the back. And that is an extremely powerful technique. The other similar technique that has made its way into the very latest generation of iPhones, and I expect it will move to other models. It may already be there that I don't know about. It's not something I've heard about before, but there's no reason that others, if they aren't, they soon will be copying this, because it's not rocket science, it's just very clever. If you have more if you have the ability to make higher resolution sensors than you technically speaking need, what if you didn't make them rectangular? What if you made them square? You made them the same width as the widest side of the rectangle you used to use, but make it a square that width. That's what Apple have done for the front-facing cameras on all of this year's iPhones. And that allows you to toggle between portrait and landscape, full resolution, full optical quality images from the same sensor through the same lens without having to rotate the phone. So now when you just choose between a vertical and a horizontal selfie, you're not giving up any quality and you're not rotating the phone. You can do either one from either angle and get full quality because the sensor is big enough to have both full-size rectangles fit. Now you might be thinking, why waste the silicon to make a square sensor when what you actually want is a cross-shaped sensor? Surely, based on what I've described, a horizontal and a vertical rectangle, overlay them on each other and you don't get a square, you get a cross. But if you do have those extra pixels, you can enable another trick. What if you don't necessarily want the exact middle? What if you want to be able to use extra information left and right or up and down from the middle? Well, now you can have in-camera image stabilization by just deciding to use different, you know, if when you're taking video now, we're now flipping into how this is useful for video. So video resolution is a little bit smaller than, it's always, not a little bit, it's substantially smaller than the resolution for the still photos on the iPhone or any other smartphone, which means that at no point was the full sensor ever being used anyway. So image stabilization was using the fudge room previously. So the video would be at a lower resolution so that as you shook the phone between video frames, what was actually happening was that the sensor shift, it's called sensor shift, but really what's happening is you're just reading different bits of the sensor and stacking them on top of each other. There's not a little motor in there moving the sensor. You're just saying, I'm going to use this little subpart of the sensor. Now I'm going to use that little subpart of the sensor. And that way you get a stable image. Well, you don't only have to do that for motion compensation. If you're only using a little bit of the image and now all of a sudden you have this big square canvas to paint with, well, now you can do that trick Apple does where the camera follows you. So you pop the phone down on a dock as you are in a meeting and you're moving around and you're not tethered as normal and the camera follows you as if you have an amazing camera crew. It's just that little piece of the sensor you're using is wandering around that entire now square on the newest iPhones, giving you a lot more room to move, literally. So it is an extremely clever feature, and it enables them to do the cool things like the dual capture selfie and front-facing mode, where you can be at a sports arena jumping around and you get a still image of your face, which is just jumping all around that sensor on the back end, you know, the sub part of the sensor where your face happens to be in that big square, while on the other end you're still zoomed into the football match or whatever, or the baseball or basketball or whatever sports ball it is. So it's absolutely impressive, and that's because of this pixel binning technique taken to the nth level. And then another technology that sort of snuck in, it doesn't quite fit into the same story of doing cleverer things by combining multiple sensors and using each sensor more intelligently. The other trick that's evolved here is LiDAR, which is basically lasers, laser beams measuring distances to things. And the reason LiDAR enters our picture is to deal with the other inherent problem we get from physically small sensors, which is a deep depth of field for normal everyday shots, which don't feel portrait-like and painterly like we would like, as we would get from more traditional, you know, full-frame DSLR lenses. And what LiDAR does, so it started off as a way of doing quick autofocus. You might have like three or four LiDAR sensors. And so that gave you three or four spots of distance that you could use to very, very quickly autofocus. But Apple took that LiDAR idea from autofocus world and literally turned it around 180 degrees and put it on the front-facing cameras and turned it from a few points into a grid of, like, I can't remember if it was 24 or, you know, or 32, but it was a grid of many points, but way less than the megapixels in the sensor, right? But nonetheless, many points. And that grid was used for Face ID because you would get this three-dimensional map of the face from that grid of LiDAR dots, LiDAR sensors. Well, Apple then made that LiDAR grid ever more fine-grained, and they added LiDAR to the other cameras, to the other side of the phone as well. So there's LiDAR dots being projected both sides of the camera now. And those LiDAR dots are building up a depth map. Now that depth map is nowhere near the resolution of the actual sensors. There's not 48 megapixels worth of depth information. But there's enough depth information now in that grid that every region of your image, every, say, 100 pixels or so, maybe it's 1,000 pixels. There's a lot of megapixels in a 48 megapixel. But you basically have this fairly fine-grained grid now where you know the physical distance to each different portion of the image, which allows you in software to accurately simulate depth of field effects to give you realistic Gaussian blurs moving between things that respect the edges and stuff. Again, a lot of machine learning happening here, but that depth grid coming from those LiDAR sensors is making that possible. And so that has given us the so-called portrait modes in our cameras. The last trick in the toolbox here is a controversial one, and it's a tool where Apple has drawn a line in the sand. I am, of course, talking about generative AI. This is large language models which can create, or rather confabulate, to use the correct technical term, which we have as a society decided to add a little bit of snark to and refer to as hallucinate. But every generative AI confabulates its answer. When you ask it to describe something, it's building that up piece by piece. It's confabulating it. When you ask it to do an intelligent fill on a piece of image that's obscured, it's confabulating it, which is another, you know, we also call it a hallucination. It's not real. It's making it up as it goes along. And Apple have decided that making things up, confabulating, that is something that if you would like to do it, you will do it when editing your photographs. Apple don't invent content in the photograph. When you take a photograph, you are taking information from the physical sensors, perhaps through multiple lenses, perhaps multiple exposures through each of those multiple lenses, all of it mushed together through that amazing image pipeline to give you one final photo. But every pixel in that photo has information that came from the physical world through the lenses, through the sensors, through the pipeline to the final image. None of it was invented. None of it was confabulated. It's all data being processed. Some other vendors have decided to give you what feels like an amazing zoom by inventing information. Oh, this mushed mess here is probably a face. I'll invent one. I'll use generative AI to invent a face. Oh, I recognize the moon. I'll copy and paste in the moon. That's really dumb generative AI, and there are cameras that do that. So that is a technique that some of the Android vendors are using to make their cameras appear to do impossible zooms. The laws of physics still apply. Apple do not do this. They will offer you generative fill, but it is a post-processing thing. Personally, I think it's deeply dishonest and deceptive to invent data when shooting photographs. That is not a camera feature. That is a photo editing feature, which sometimes is appropriate to use when you're making artistic, creative work, and utterly, abjectly, morally wrong when you are capturing journalistic work. So to have cameras do that behind your back is immoral. It is wrong. And I'm so relieved that Apple have not decided to become dishonest in that particular way. I really am cranky about people using generative AI in cameras, right? That is an editing feature. Do not blur the line. Okay. Having been a little bit cranky at the end, let me end on a happier note. What I hope I've explained to you is the absolutely astonishing technical wizardry that exists between the tap of that camera button on your iPhone or your Android phone and the photograph that appears fractions of a second later. It's jaw-dropping how much is happening in the few millimeters between the physical front of that lens and the screen behind it where you're looking at the image. It is amazing. Most of the time, it's a feature, not a bug, we're oblivious to it, because that's how it should be. Get out of my way. I'm interested in the creative part of image taking. I am trying to create photographs. I don't need to be thinking about all this technical wizardry. You do that, I'll do the photographing. And the phones let us do that. In tiny little devices that fit in our pocket and that we have with us all the time, and they take these amazing photographs. So while it is amazing that you don't have to think about all of this amazing complexity, every now and then, take a moment and just appreciate how amazing it is. I have been your host, Bart Bouchotz. You can find me at bartb.ie, and you will find an essay version of this discussion in the show notes at let's-talk.ie. You will also find buttons there to support the show. You will have noticed there were no ads, there are no sponsors. This show is 100% listener supported. Each and every one of you who have made that possible over the years, thank you. Literally, the show wouldn't exist without you. That's what it means to be listener supported. And to those of you continuing to support the show today so that it can continue into the future, thank you. That support can be financial through Patreon for a monthly contribution or PayPal for a one-off donation, or it can effectively be in kind by spreading the word. The bigger the audience, the more opportunity there is for people to contribute financially, because yes, I do enjoy providing something of value to the community. The server bills and other bills, software subscriptions and all these kind of things that come with making one of these podcasts and the new hardware that has to be bought periodically, I can't pay for that with goodwill. So it is because of your both financial and goodwill style support that this show continues to exist. So thank you all. If you don't already support the show, please consider it, be that by spreading the word or by giving financially. Both are appreciated. I'm going to stop dragging this on any longer. I've been your host, Bart Bouchotz. As I said, you can find me at bartb.ie. I will give another quick final plug to friend of the show, Alison Sheridan, who inspired this episode. You will find her amazing work at podfeet.com, where she does the NosillaCast, Chit Chat Across the Pond, and every now and then other cool and fun things. Until next time, happy snapping.